So we are recording now.
We are recording.
Whoa, we have very high levels on the recording. And then now I have to check. Everyone has to hear this. Until we get an actual engineer. Refresh. Okay. Sooner or later we should hear something there.
Hello?
Let's see. It'll come through. It's that one where it goes through the delay. You know, like it takes a while for us to hear ourselves. A little behind the scenes for everybody who listens to the podcast. There's a vending machine outside that dispenses Pabst Blue Ribbons for $2.
I saw that. Pabst Blue Ribbons, drumsticks, guitar strings, that's and
freaking awesome.
Everything you need to be a star.
Oh, wait. That's us a little bit. It's very, very distorted. Wait.
I think that's actually the computer, though.
Yeah, I believe it is. Okay. Well, here
okay,
we are.
So we are recording and we are broadcasting.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everybody. It is the 30th of April, 2009.
101 days.
101 days into the 44th president's term. And we are on, this is what's left on isgoodradio.com and also on Pod-O-Matic and also on iTunes.
And yay.
We are netcasting from the cool new studio. That's it's awesome. It's pretty awesome.
Great to be here.
Very excited. We should try and get a band in here.
I think we should.
I think we
a house band for every week.
We should. That would be awesome. So
or a heavily politicized band that will beat us over the head with their drumsticks.
When that would be great.
We have opposing ideas.
Some machine or something.
Yeah.
So it's a huge week. It was a huge week. It's a huge, huge
it's
day.
It's never, ever boring, right?
Not right
no matter,
now.
No matter when you know, think that it might be boring, it isn't.
It is so not boring right now. It's insane. And every day is a new surprise.
Every single day.
So we both brought stuff. I didn't really
bring anything. It looks like I did, but I didn't.
Haven't actually introduced ourselves.
I'm
Greg Maratea.
I'm Stephen Adams.
Okay, so when we are the What's Left crew. Katrina cannot be with us tonight. She would have been great to be here for the 1H1N virus or the 1N1H virus.
It would have been great because that one's, you know, sort of got its own political ramifications, doesn't it?
It does.
Joe Biden, you know, mouthing off about public transportation, even though he's famous for using it.
The first true Bidenism of the Obama presidency.
And it was a doozy.
It was a good one.
I wouldn't allow my family or anyone, I wouldn't advise anyone to take public transportation or fly.
Or be in any confined space.
Yes.
All it takes is one sneeze and that gets...
It's like, guys, you know, and actually the longer we sit with this, and okay, I'm not minimizing the illness or anyone who has any death or anyone who's suffering from this, but, you know, as someone pointed out today, you know, we've had 149 deaths, I believe, in Mexico, and we're now talking about millions of surgical masks. We've had millions of people dying of AIDS, but it's very difficult to get people wearing condoms. Yeah. And I'm not saying that it's the same thing, but it's interesting that, you know, we react differently to different things.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, pig virus, pandemic.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's funny. And it's also that misnomer, and they're changing the name now because, you know, in Egypt, they slaughtered 300,000 pigs.
Yeah.
Hasn't been a single case of the... virus.
They don't eat them. The pigs are there
They do eat them. Christians do eat them.
Yeah.
There's a market for them.
But there are very few.
300,000 pigs is not a lot of pigs.
Yeah.
But those who are farming them are livid because their market has disappeared overnight.
But I also heard on NPR that they also use pigs as a form of waste disposal, that they have people who sort the garbage and actually the edible stuff that the pigs will eat, they kind of.
Right, which the pigs pretty much eat anything. So.
Yeah.
That's why ham tastes so good.
Yeah, I know. And I know that they've in the United States, they've made a, a conscious effort to not call it the swine
in the last day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
Just in case anyone hadn't heard, Joe Biden probably got the biggest soundbite on NPR this morning, with his, this is just me. This is Joe Biden. It's how he starts it.
Yeah. But the problem is he's not Joe. This is the thing that bugs me. You're not just Joe. You're the vice president of the United States. What you say has import, and you're not a private citizen voicing an opinion. So you can't consider things from that point of view.
I know. Well, you know what just cracked me up is I was like, why did he pick Biden again? Like, not just because of this quote, but
his foreign policy experience.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
But then he surrounded himself with like a million foreign policy people.
Yeah.
He's got Richard Holbrooke. He's got Hillary Clinton
herself, the one and only.
The one and only Hillary Clinton. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, he has no shorty. He has a former majority leader.
And I can't keep, I'm sorry, I keep marveling over the brilliance of putting Hillary in that position as opposed to VP.
To shut her up.
Well, yeah, I mean, Joe Biden talked about that, and one of Mrs. Biden talked about that on television. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah,
that
they offered him
that. Little gaffe where he had the choice of VP or Secretary of State.
I really do think it was just a calculated decision to keep Hillary out of domestic policy.
She's out of domestic policy. She's out of Washington, but she's very, very important. She's doing what she does best. It's pretty great.
And
she knows a lot of these people.
She's been very low profile.
She has.
She's been a dutiful soldier.
But there has been a profile. I mean, there has definitely been an ongoing profile.
Well, when she says something, it's never overlooked.
No.
Ever. But she's not upstaging her boss, and she's possibly the only one of a handful of politicians that could upstage
who could right now.
Barack Obama. But yeah, no, I
Nancy
I think
Pelosi wants to.
Dude, he's on a crash course with Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was the Karl Rove criticism, was that too much was given to her in the beginning, and now he's going to pay the price for it.
There was an article I read today about how he...
But we kind of agree with that in a way.
He blew it on allowing the stimulus package to be drafted in the House.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, and it's a political liability, because if it does not succeed, or even if it fails for reasons that are beyond his control, this will come back to haunt him. There needed to be more White House supervision, and there should have been, because he's made so much ado about it. There should have been a more of a pronounced bipartisan effort in this department.
Yeah, I agree.
What's done is done.
I agree, and actually, what I find pretty, but I mean, they're also talking about how Obama may punt whether or not to go after Bush administration officials for the torture memos to Pelosi, who is aching to do that. I think, honestly, you know, I'm going to speak from a strict political standpoint. Bagram Air Force Base, you know, notwithstanding.
Well, that's your presumption. We don't have any proof of that.
Whatever the case may be, that just to give deference to the fact this is not addressing the concerns about whether or not we actually torture. I think it would be overreaching. I think that the thing that would upset the political apple cart for Barack Obama would be to allow the Democrats to go forward in Congress to go forward with
prosecution
and truth. And was it the truth in hearings, the truth in I want to say reconciliation, but it's not it, but you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. And
the truth commissions, I think that's the one thing that would screw up what's basically a flawless political operation right now.
I mean, right down to getting Arlen Specter on his 100th day. Arlen is a pure political creature himself. I mean, I'm not saying but in terms of, you know, a coup on that particular non-event day, it's pretty interesting.
In true form, every time Obama does a press conference, there's an event that's larger than it, either the day before or the day over the day after. Every one of his primetime press conferences, he's had three now. And I'll be honest with you, as soon as I heard Specter flipped, I was immediately, I'm going to give this all to Rachel Maddow, because she did it on her show, exactly how it went, how my feelings went. And she said, we don't normally do this, but we're going to do a bit of political, what is it? Political,
forensics, in a way?
Political theater. Political theater. And so her cohort, the one guy who comes on at the end of her show, comes and he goes, these were Democrats when they heard Arlen Specter flipped, and they have this fake curtain that pulls back, and there's Rachel Maddow, and she's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he goes, and then these are Democrats 5 minutes later when they realize that Arlen Specter is really a Republican. And then the curtain pulls back and there's Rachel Maddow stunned and she's not saying a word.
That's funny.
Well, that's, by the way, Joe Biden. Joe Biden and Henry Reid, Harry Reid,
the ones
that got...
Yeah, they worked it on the commuter train. Literally.
They did, quite literally. And they had worked on him for years. But the reality is this, they could have picked up that seat. They were going to pick up that seat, and they can still lose. They can lose.
Well, Arlen Specter
lose that seat.
Probably will not lose that seat.
Well, his poll numbers went up as soon as he flipped.
Exactly, and yeah, he saw what was happening in his state already. Uh-huh. So it was politically expedient for him.
On the president's 100th day, Arlen Specter voted against his budget. Voted against the president's budget.
Right.
The day before. He said, even though I'm changing, I'm not changing on the unionization, the easy unionization.
He's made it clear. This is, I mean, to me, this is not about the Democrats. This is about a gentleman's political survival.
It is.
And it's very clear cut.
But it doesn't do anything for, the only thing I can think of is if the White House was involved at all in this, if Rahm Emanuel or one of the congressional liaisons were involved in this, then what they've extracted from Specter is one rubber stamp, and it's probably healthcare. It's either healthcare or judicial, but I think it's healthcare.
It's going to be healthcare.
Something that he can,
because
he
the rest they can't control, and I don't think they would expect to.
I think it's the only thing they get out of this. Otherwise, it's all downside. We were going to beat Specter. We were going to beat Specter. And now they might get Tom Ridge to run against him, who's the perfect Republican to win that seat.
We shall see.
I mean, I think it was great. And I think that it says it does more to hurt the Republicans than it does to help Barack Obama.
I think that's my assessment, too. Is that it hurts them, and the symbolism alone is enough to make them feel a party like that's in disarray, and all they can really do is attack.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, you know, it's what they seem to do best, but in this instance, it's not working for them, because you've got Newt Gingrich out with his guns, you've got Karl Rove out with his guns, you've got Dick Cheney out with his guns, and it isn't working.
Well, no,
because they can, you know, they can keep trying to characterize these actions as socialism and all the buzzwords that frighten Americans, the stupid teabagging, you know, incidents where, you know, yes, 5% of the population, as we talked about, is going to feel, I think, what amounts to about $36 a week if you're making $250,000 and up a year. That is not a significant. Yeah, that's the way it breaks down. Yeah. I think $36.50 a week. For someone with an income of $250,000 or up, that's like an okay lunch for someone
for
making
someone
that
who's
much
making
money.
That kind of money.
Yeah, you just skip one of those and your tax bill is addressed.
Right, right.
That's also, by the way, and this is something that Americans need to remember, that category is only 5% of the population making $250,000 and up.
I heard it was 2.
Let him say making $250,000 and up. Okay. And maybe 5%, that's everybody from there up to the millions.
Yeah.
95% of the population works on a sum much less than that, which you all probably know.
Oh, yeah. With respect to the Republican Party, I think that the thing that Specter, if there is no other deal, the thing that Specter said this week was there's basically a purity test, and it's my way or the highway, and they're vindictive. And he was then said, and I was denied my chairmanship.
Right. Well, there's that too.
Which, you know, takes it takes it down from the lofty the lofty rhetoric it started off at.
Down to what we know what it really is all
which
about.
Which, I mean, look, Arlen Specter's move is about, for him, it's about winning in Pennsylvania when he was going to get a primary challenger that he looked like he couldn't beat. It's looking to get on the right side of Barack Obama. To a certain extent, if Barry helps him win re-election, then it works for him in 2000. It works for Barack Obama in 2012. I mean, there's a lot of upside there.
Right.
The downside is you have a Republican in the fold. He is a
Republican, in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, he is a Republican. He's not going to vote with the party all the time. We do not have a filibuster-proof majority.
No,
there
we
must
don't.
Be a deal for the.
That's a
vote.
Media construct, and it's a really naive one. So, yeah.
Right now, it depends on how it goes, but just like it was Sandra Day O'Connor's court when she was the swing vote on the right. on the Supreme Court. It is Specter, Ben Nelson, is it Susan Collins of Maine and Olympia Snow of Maine?
Olympia Snow, yeah.
It's there. They are the gang of whatever, but what remains of the gang of 14 that will make or break Obama's agenda, especially on the tough stuff, which, by the way, don't worry, it's just the screensaver. Come on, everyone.
I'm just enjoying it. It was drawing me off of this planet into the universe.
It brings. Oh, by the way, it brings us into what was the breaking news as we're going to record. This is David Souter is
now confirmed to be leaving.
Yeah, I have to give props to Political Wire. In the afternoon, they said, "Is Souter dropping hints because he didn't staff up?
Didn't
his
staff
clerks.
Up? Yeah,
and." Then he quit, or is supposedly confirmed to resign.
Resign. If as soon as his replacement is chosen.
You look, man. I'm gonna not to mention his name twice in one show, but Rahm Emanuel is ready to replace at least two or three Supreme Court justices.
I'm sure he is. We've got
John Paul Stevens is about what 89, 87.
Jesus.
You got Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who somehow went in for one of the most deadly cancers
and survived
it. Survived it,
which I am. Totally impressed by.
Yeah. Well, I think Ruth is going to hang on for dear life.
Yeah.
And she did drop the hint at the photo this year. Soon, pretty soon there'll be another picture. There'll be another person in this photo. And everyone
right.
thought it was her, but she must have known that Souter was going to leave. But, I mean, I think Obama's going to need...
Clarence Thomas would go away.
Clarence Thomas is young.
I know, but I can still dream, can't I?
I know. The
thing is, he's such an interesting man. He's so intelligent, but he's so twisted.
I don't understand why he doesn't flex if he's so intelligent. He's silent. He does write opinions, but not that many.
Not that many. I've listened to his interviews, and that's what I'm saying. I was startled by his intelligence, but there's a lack of substance in his character somewhere. He's gotten the position, and he just sort of occupies it.
I always got the feeling that he was a conservative because it suited his goals.
Mm. Which are?
To be a Supreme Court justice.
Right, now that he's there.
That
he makes nothing of it, really.
Yeah, well, he wasn't going to flip.
Yeah.
I mean, we just lucked out in that we got one of the Republican nominees to the court to wait till a Democrat became president.
Right.
To retire. David Souter was George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41.
Yes, he was.
And surprised the shit out of everybody by not being a moderate. By the way, that's the last time the Democrats in Congress had power is when 41 had to find a moderate to put on the court.
Jesus.
He came up with Souter.
It's been a while, guys.
Right? Since they've had that kind of...
Jesus.
But I mean, getting back to that, the Democrats are still on the upswing. I think Obama's managed to... separate himself from the pack, but the Democrats in Congress are doing okay, mainly because Obama's team is deft at keeping some of the worst things out of their hands.
I want to go back to the torture memos. I mean, what is your opinion about the revelations?
On the torture memos?
Mm-hmm.
We knew they were doing this.
No, I understand that, but I'm saying, do you think that, let me rephrase myself. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the revelations are making us less safe, as has been posited? Do you think that... this revisionism has any value? Do you think that we are giving reason for terrorists to hate us more than they already do?
No. That one I'll cut you off and say no. We're not giving them any more fuel for the fire with those.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm pretty much believe that we are hated on a level that people don't necessarily grasp.
Plus, I think that I think that George W. Bush. His deterrent power was he's freaking loco.
Right.
You know, I think that no one thought that there would be a guy who would come along who would break as many rules and do whatever the F it took like him.
Right.
And he wanted them to know that. I think that the enemy has known about this because he wanted them to know this is if I get my hands on you.
I'll do this too.
We're not playing by any fair rules.
But the problem is that, you know, I don't think that is any kind of deterrent. I mean, I think that someone who wants to do that is who's also already willing to die, who's willing to fly a plane into a building, who's willing to strap bombs to their bodies and walk in holding hands of children right. into markets, is not going to be deterred by the idea of torture. Now, that is something that exalts their spirit.
I agree with you on that, but I also think that... I forgot which one. One of the masterminds that they supposed masterminds of 9/11 that they caught when they got him into court, they said he was a mess. They said he was a mess. They had fucked with him so much. They had tortured him so much that he was broken.
Right.
And I think that the guy who's willing to kill himself would rather die in a blaze of glory than be a broken man.
Right. But I don't know that people think it through to that degree, or if they do. I mean, you know, they break you, but they don't allow you the opportunity to kill yourself because it's not possible, unless you perhaps starve yourself. But they can find ways to make right. you eat anyway.
I think that there are secrets that they got. I don't know if they necessarily got them through torture. I think that they have gotten intelligence enough that people on the other side of the supposed war on terror realized someone big gave this up. For them to have bombed this house, for them to have
bombed. But I guess what I'm saying is that with the abolition of terror, do you think that what's left to us is going to be as effective?
With the abolition of torture?
Yeah. I mean, torture, not the abolition of terror. That was a wishful thought on my part.
I know. I was like, wow.
It's over. Okay, everybody, you can go home. There's no more terror.
You asked a multi-point question. My first strongest response is the world, it being revealed, anything that the Bush administration did being revealed to the world doesn't hurt us anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's my opinion. It's already out there. I mean, for God's sake, Michael Moore had a film filled with photos and footage of things that were going on. Everyone knows.
Yeah, that so doesn't...
It's sort of like a non... It's like
that's a non-starter.
It's like the Kelly McGillis revelation.
That's yes. it's also... That's up there with... It's just Republican election year rhetoric that they're hoping they can take some form of root in a year or two or maybe in four.
I think I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Because
I feel like the real effect here is more of a discrediting of that party.
Yeah, but
for people who didn't believe any of this was going on before,
right?
And also they've made another show because you mentioned the guy, I cannot remember his name right now, who was put on trial and who received a sentence, who had been held for 5 years.
Right,
he pled guilty. He is going to go to prison for his part in the 9/11 conspiracy. So you know, was it really necessary to hold him this long? These are the questions that we're asking. It's like delaying justice. The man and now his. I think part of his defense is that the 5 years that he spent in jail should be used against his sentence, and the law will probably favor that. I think that.
Oh, yeah,
right. I think that we, you know, we got to move more swiftly here. Spending time torturing them is.
I think that they're still torturing people. I don't think that Barack Obama is completely washing his hands of torturing people. I think that the way it's being done is the way it used to be done, which is. You have some rogue nations that you like in public denounce, and in private you use to do a lot of doing all your dirty work.
Well, I mean, for example, the ways around it is that, you know, a way around it is that if the military has captured someone, then what they do to them is within the boundaries of war. It's not ordered by the government directly in that same way.
The way around it is the Pakistani military gets somebody. Right. The way around it is the Egyptians get a hold, the Turkish get a hold of someone. Or someone that's not necessarily on our payroll.
I mean, we can outsource torture.
Yeah, no, and I think that is definitely going on. And I'm not even a conspiracy theory, you know.
It's not about conspiracy. I think it's just about, as what you mentioned last week, it's plausible deniability. It's creating a situation where the desired effect is created without necessarily the specific knowledge being delivered to the man in charge or those in charge.
Right.
You know, as we say, you know, the circumstances themselves may... allow us to get what we want out of a situation without necessarily directly ordering it.
As I view it, and a lot of this just came to me listening to you now, if you look at the torture memos, the first thing is it's a down payment on trying to repair relations with a certain number of people in the world. Hopefully, in theory, it's helping to diffuse the hatred in whatever world you want to call it, Muslim, Middle East, Arab, Pakistani world, it's part of that.
I don't know what to call it. I mean, I remember, you know.
We always say Muslim, and I'm always like, it's such a one.
It's kind of not Muslim. It is a fanatic. It's a world of fanatics who happen to be Muslim.
Right. So, but,
I mean, just as, you know, I mean, because, you know, that's too broad and it's insulting to the majority of people who are not adhering to this thinking.
But the torture.
But I have to say something. I have to say something. I remember September 11th in being stuck in London. I was doing a show and I was stuck there. And London is a very cosmopolitan city, as we know. And one evening I went out walking with one of my producing partners and we walked back through because we were stuck there for damn near till October, because we couldn't get a flight out. So I thought, well, hell, let's just make the best of it and just, you know, enjoy ourselves. But we walked back through Hyde Park one night, as you know, and there was a fire near the speaker's corner. And I thought, this is after dark. It doesn't seem like it could be authorized. My partner, of course, wanted to go and see. Mm-hmm. I'm like, not a good idea. Because we have two different sets of instincts on these things. But he rushes up and we get there. There was a huge crowd of Middle Eastern people burning Uncle Sam in effigy. And I mean hundreds of people.
What year is this?
This was in 2001. This was September, after September 11th. We're stuck in the country. So we kind of, I was like, as I thought, not good, and even harder for an American to explain why they would be in the presence of something this extreme. And I mean, honestly, this is the first time I really grasped, like, seeing hundreds of people burning Uncle Sam in effigy and cheering, you know, thrilled with what had happened in New York.
Right.
And really, and this is the thing, that you didn't see all this in the United States. You saw it happening in the Middle East. I saw it on European television, happening in England, happening in France. People were jubilant.
Right.
And we're talking about thousands of people who then, of course, we know spent time bombing London as well.
Right.
It's that was the first time I understood how palpable the hatred was. And we got the hell out of that park very quickly. And of course, the bobbies rolled in and the whole thing went crazy. And I have to tell you, I was in shock.
Right.
It was really frightening. And
see, that to me is part.
And none of this stuff makes the American news. I don't think we understand that, you know, the threat we're talking about is closer to us than we realize, and it's not a construction. On that part, I give it up. It is real.
Oh yeah.
And you know, I've seen this when I lived in France. I saw the crap that went on there when they were using Paris as, you know, a theater for for other issues.
Right. Well, Algerians weren't they the terrorists in France?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, Arab anti-Jewish demonstrations.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it goes on and on and on.
On that level, though, what that hatred comes from is not. That's the hegemony of the United States being felt by people, and that's where I think that the seeds of that hatred is sown. If you're in the United States and you're not looking out, you don't realize what has been done in our name to keep, you know, the United States
in the position that it occupies.
Yep. Yep.
Truly, although I have to say a lot of this is a British inheritance, and I guess some of that has come to roost for them as well.
Yeah, I mean, the British Empire and the French Empire.
Not that, we're not talking about a dissipation of it's still fairly recent.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the situation in Iraq is directly traceable to the arbitrary lines that created Iraq,
yeah.
You know, drawing together people who will never harmonize.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
and the British,
we talk
idea
about the difficulty of that Israel was put in when it was created, because, you know, you drive the situation into
existence.
It in
there, yeah.
And then of course the people have to defend themselves, and voila, it just becomes this never ending.
Yeah. No, I completely concur. And people in the United States are completely ill-informed about those realities, the historic realities that have brought us to this point.
I mean, the same thing goes on, you know, we can talk about the instability in Africa. A lot of that is the same thing. Right. Rwanda was all about, you know, a post-colonial aftermath of two people who never got along being forced to live in the same country.
Right.
So, I mean, it goes on and on.
One of the reasons why I'm very much against, not very much against, I know we have to do it, but one of the downsides of all sanctions, I'm against when we sanction a country, is that it pumps a shitload of money into an underground rogue element that is usually a network that supplies things, whether it be weapons or drugs. You know, when we clamp down on North Korea with some more sanctions because of their nuclear test,
yeah,
there will
become
be
a hotbed for
criminal element that will thrive in that. There will be a corruption element that will thrive in that, and the people who pay the price are the people who are supposed to rise up and topple their leadership who don't, right, because they're suppressed.
Because they can't.
Yes.
Because they're starving and they can barely survive in all these wonderful conditions.
And then we sit on the sidelines and, you know, we don't even sit on the sides. Our nation just, you know, reaps the rewards.
So, you know, my other question, you know, because I'm not sure how I feel about this too, is do you feel that Obama's international posture is a set of apologies? Do you think that it's weakening people's perception of what we're capable of, that we will? But I mean,
that's a Republican line.
No, I'm just asking you.
In 2010. I think that his first stage was,
I know, it's a Republican line. That's why I wanted to say it to irritate you.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's, I think to quote Bill Clinton, that's a dog that's not going to hunt.
Right.
I mean, I don't see.
Well, I think he shocked them with the Somalian situation.
Sure.
And I don't think they were ready for that. And now Russia's, you know, people have gotten very aggressive in that arena suddenly. Right. Of course, the French started.
I think Obama's thing was I had no patience to watch his economic plan unfold. And I still, at this point, have very little patience for some of the things he says he's going to do to keep us from spending ourselves into oblivion. Mm-hmm. But I have a certain amount of, I get what his policy is.
Right.
With respect to the world stage, I see it clearly. The first stage, the first wave, the foundation on his new foreign policy is to do the listening and leading tour, mm-hmm, and to fess. You know, those torture memos probably did more to diffuse anti-Bushism in the continent of Europe than it did anywhere else, to be quite honest with you. And I think that what he's trying to do is foster as much goodwill so that he can cash it in. He's building back up our soft power. He's building back up our political goodwill. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's doing it in the United States with his popularity. They're keen to make sure that his popularity is not touched because it's rolling the Republicans. It's making them, it's splintering that party on a daily basis. Destroying them.
It's fascinating to watch what they do to one another.
Yeah. And there's an easy, to me,
I mean, I love the fact that, for example, Meghan McCain's being attacked by factions of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
It's kind of extraordinary.
The pugnacious, pundit class of the Republicans are going after Meghan.
Yeah, they are.
I was going to send you the link to this, and I did not. There was a fictitious first 100 days of the McCain administration. And Meghan.
Break it down.
Meghan's line, and it was, she's remarkably quiet, went back to private life. it was very funny. They had him choosing some of the same people and doing some of the same things, but having a less than 50% popularity rating and, you know, going nowhere fast was basically, but it was, his foreign policy was strikingly similar to, what we've seen unfold with Barack Obama.
Interesting. Interesting.
Let me ask you a question. Oh, you didn't see the press conference. You heard the press conference.
I listened to the press conference. I never got to watch anything.
What
I listened to the radio.
What did you think about that?
I liked it. I enjoyed it. I think that he put a lot of things in perspective. I think that, he answered a lot. I mean, he answered a lot of the stupid things that I'm putting in your world right now.
Right.
These slogans that people express as if they're true and they have their little sticking power if you let them, but he's very deft at capturing them and addressing them in a way that diffuses their ability to do what they're intended to do.
His hallmark moment for that, for me, in that press conference was, people keep saying, Obama, he wants to grow this federal government. Let me tell you, if I could just come in to, and you said the banks are humming and cars are selling and you just got to get healthcare under control, deal with two wars and a pandemic flu, I would take that deal.
Yeah.
That is exactly what you're talking about. That moment where he dispels the criticism with him in a heartbeat.
Because that's what they'd like us to believe. That, you know, the right wing would like us to believe that the man wants to grow this monstrous government that will control every aspect of your life, socialize everything down to some sort of mediocre level, so that we, and God forbid, have things that are like Europe, you know, which are horrible. So I just, you know, it, what was the other question? I can't remember the reporter's name that asked him.
Whether he was enchanted.
Now that, no, the one before, the question before that was pretty funny. The question about now that you're in the business of owning this, that, and the other. And he, again, it was like, he put it right back. I don't want to be in the auto business. I don't want to run a bank. These were not things anybody desired.
My favorite part about that, and just to get all the people who are going to criticize us for this show is about the politics, not the activism of government. And my favorite thing about what's going on right now with Barack Obama is that he's being able to spin all the levers, all the tools of power that the Republicans did. And he's doing it much more effectively for policies that are to a certain extent better guided.
Right.
And one of my favorite parts was in that particular answer, he said, I don't know how to build design an efficient plug-in hybrid, but the Japanese can. Well, if the Japanese can, well, doggone it, we should be able to do it.
Yeah,
and use the word doggone it.
It's such a hearty old American expression.
Yeah, and it's just straight out of Bush, you know, out of Bush's playbook, you know, maybe Reagan, but really out of Bush.
The guy does have Midwestern roots and he does kind of go there. He always has.
And it is his way of
relating his way.
The issue. But I mean, come on, the guy's fucking Ivy League educated.
I know, but come on. We know we like our politicians sort of sleeves rolled up just like us, even though they're not
from the campaign.
Yeah.
But what I saw going through that was, here's a guy whose team has got a grasp on this and he comes straight at it, every time. What I found very interesting was in my flipping through the channels, I heard O'Reilly and O'Reilly said, you know, he gives these 7-minute answers.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean a man who actually considers what he's saying, has actually given it some thought?
Yep.
Wow.
He said he gives him these, he bloviates for 7 minutes and...
Okay. That's a style concern, Bill. You bloviate for hours. I wish you would go away. But
yeah.
What can I do about it?
But it was just so funny.
Freedom of speech and all that.
The nation's cool with it.
The nation's probably relieved. I mean, they actually are not. They're being given intelligent answers and they're not being spoken down to at the same time.
Yeah,
and they're actually being addressed in a way that they appreciate. And clearly, that's part of why he's there.
Yeah, and you know, there were certain things that he addressed in that press conference that I thought were. I mean, he eventually asked to step up and deliver. Especially with respect to, I think he was asked, I can't remember the name of the case, but it's one of the things that he's condemned for from the left, which is he took the same position as the Bush administration on releasing information during a legal proceeding against a terror suspect. And his answer to that was, we came into office and this case is pending.
Right.
And we didn't have time to study it from head to toe. So we took the position of the previous administration. Now, do I think that that's the correct position? Yeah. Do I think that's the correct position? No. But do I also see times when you can't actually go into a court with the information you've got because it would reveal covert activities or yes, I do believe that. And I thought, okay, here you go. That's a relatively honest answer. He's basically saying, yeah, sometimes we're going to do some dirty shit and we can't tell anyone about it.
Right.
You know, and I found that.
Well, I mean, that's the sort of dark side that he's going to have, as we were saying, he's going to have to wrestle with, because we don't know what's going to happen. He may find himself in a position where he's going to have to do all kinds of things.
I think he's following the Clinton mold on terms of suppressing terrorism, which is you keep the armed services well funded. Clinton threw a shitload of money at Y2K. Not at the bug, but at the actual year, at the actual terror, at, you know, the possibility of terrorist plots in the year 2000 and the years. And he lucked out in one instance, but by and large, it worked. So, you know, overall, I think that that's what Obama's team is following as a model, which is just keep the defense. And I think, honestly, I think he's going to keep Gates. If Gates will stay on, I think he's going to keep Robert Gates.
It was a good move to do that. I think the continuity was necessary.
Did you? There was a great article on how Gates's budget was perfectly released. The Defense Department budget. He essentially chose the week that every senator and basically Congress went home for spring break. And by doing so, there was no, the allies that would coalesce and decry the changes in the budget weren't in one spot. They were at home here getting an earful from their constituents about bailouts.
Right.
And he also chose wisely so that the opposition would be fractured as to how he would go about it. And they think he's going to get 90% of the change.
That's kind of incredible.
Which is more than Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld, everyone forgets, Rumsfeld was on his way out. He was going to be the first Bush administration official to be gone because he rubbed everyone the wrong way by trying to revolutionize the Defense Department into its small footprint, high destruction model that he envisioned.
Right.
And 9/11 brought him back into power.
You know,
his media stardom, actually, from 9/11 briefings brought him back into power.
I have another question, and I don't know the answer, really. What is Halliburton doing now?
They're still in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I know they're still in Iraq, but in what levels? I mean, do we know what levels? Have the levels been reduced? Has there been any punishment for these creatures?
No, I know that Obama said that they're trying to reduce.
What is the? I mean, because I haven't studied enough about Halliburton to really understand it, but I know that it's not that old, but it seems deeply connected to the government in ways that
Halliburton started out as a good idea, and the idea was this: if you're going to pay someone in the military, you should have them in a combat or combat. Not support, yeah, maybe a combat support role. So things that aren't combat support, like cooking, cleaning, you know, the varying things you can contract out.
Right. Yeah, I guess
these grew and grew and grew
into this current state where it's essentially another army which isn't beholden.
No.
And this is what disturbs me about it. And I don't understand why it is that we can't train people to do the things they're doing and save money, billions of dollars, I might add.
You know, that's, to me, it just seems like there's, in my business, in the post production business, there's a cycle. There's the new guy comes into the studio and says, everything is going to be done in a studio facility on the lot.
Right.
We're going to save all this money. And then that doesn't work because for whatever reason, they're just not that competitive. I don't know how it works. They just don't get people who do the job efficiently, quickly, for the right price. They get out of touch with real competition. And then a new guy comes in and says, I'm going to throw this all out. I'm going to bid everything out. And whoever comes in with the lowest bid is going to get my work. And these are,
yeah, but nobody, but Halliburton doesn't have competition, really.
Well, I think that when you said, how can we get people to do what they want, what they're supposed to do, and have it not cost money? I think it's the army goes through a period where they go, all right, we'll have all these privates do all this shit.
Right.
And then they go, all right, well, no, we'll farm it out. Remember now, it benefited Bill Clinton to have contractors taking over. The Defense Department budget went down and did the same services by having contractors do it. You know, I mean, it benefits politicians to have this happen. And then when it doesn't work, they'll bring it back in. They'll eventually bring it back in. They did the same thing in the New York City cops. I think they had cops that stopped them from being in administrative roles. Your last 3 or 4 years out, like in the precinct, you know, in the actual precinct, you're like, no, you gotta
stay in the field.
On the field, yeah.
Come on, guys. These guys deserve their moment at the desk.
They do.
And not only that, I mean, you know, to take away administration from somebody who actually understands what they're administering is a little bit foolish, but what do I know?
Well, I mean, then that's why these things go in cycles.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they go in cycles.
But I mean, this is a fairly new thing. I mean, we didn't have privateers in World War II. We didn't have this sort of thing in the past. It's
World War II is a tough one to use as a model because we were a nation that did not build as much armament until we needed to go to war.
Right.
And it was after World War II
that we've remained in this sort of constant war. I understand that, but I'm saying, you know, all this is very recent, so it's hard to talk about it in terms of cycles in a really meaningful way because it's new.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say that you'll see in our lifetime, you'll see a the army's taking it back in.
I think that would make sense right now.
And then someone will come along and say,
because Halliburton was very problematic in Iraq.
Yeah, but they'll say, why do we have privates cooking food? We should have them out in the field. Why do we have privates building, you know?
Well, I mean, that's fine. I'm talking about security, for example.
And like all that farmed out security?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. This is my objection. I'm not really so concerned about, you know, who's doing KP. But, you know, but here's what I'm saying. When private companies wind up influencing international politics because they make mistakes or they assume something's going on and they kill, you know, innocent civilians, yeah, like what happened, you know, last year, more than once, this is a problem.
Right.
This is the kind of stuff I'm talking about.
I mean, that part I get.
Anyway, we're going in circles.
To me, that's a product of the Rumsfeld way of doing things. I don't know if Robert Gates would
allow that to relax.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember, Rumsfeld was all about light and destructive. Yeah. Light footprint, high destruction. So if you need to get some rogues to go in there and bang some heads afterwards, and you don't really give a shit whether innocents are killed, so you get Blackwater and shit like that.
God, I loved... that's actually what I was, you know, talking about the entire time with my hungry state. It was actually Blackwater. Referred to them as Halliburton.
Halliburton was, that's why I was on the services thing.
Yeah. I meant Blackwater.
Didn't Blackwater change their name too?
I need to have dinner before I can do the show. Yeah, they did change their name because of their
horrible,
hideously
image.
Besmirched image.
All right, so let me ask you.
See, I couldn't even remember them. They actually have a really strange, I can't remember their name now.
It's probably like the Freedom Fries group or something.
Something like that.
Freedom of Tears. Okay, so this week, a lot of stuff went on in the House of Representatives. The credit card Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
Got out. Still has to go to conference between the House and Senate.
It's good, though.
Credit card Bill of Rights got out. The mortgage relief bill
got out. This is great. This is great stuff to me.
Yeah, no, this is where when people tell me there's no difference between the two parties, I just point to the credit card Bill of Rights. Just for anyone to know, there's a slideshow going on my computer, and it's just a series of random photographs that are there. So
it's mesmerizing
me. Mesmerized with like a lot of them being my own self worship.
Well, no, but there's so many strange things there. I'm losing my train of thought.
They
started a blank wall now, but I'm fascinated.
No. I just want to go through some of the things that happened this week. The credit card Bill of Rights got out. And it will be a little watered down in the Senate, but I think they'll get something that's relatively got teeth.
I know, but heretofore, an arena that has never been regulated in any way, the things these people can do.
Heretofore, it was watered down in the first 6 months. The credit cards toothed up in the first 6 months of the Bush administration.
Exactly.
Now they're getting fucked with.
They should be, bastards. It's amazing.
But one thing that we lost this week that was a big loss, and it's that damn supposed filibuster-proof Senate is...
that's not real, but go on.
The supposed cram-down bill in for mortgages, which is the mortgage relief bill, that for subprime mortgages, people who have not been offered refi or ways out... they put in it's one of Obama's proposals. It'll be like $71 billion aimed at people who are upside down or in subprime mortgages that are verging on foreclosure. And the bill's whole goal was to, seed money to, the loan servicing and banks, loan servicing organizations and banks to entice them to refi some of these people or write down principal on some of these people so that people wouldn't have to go into foreclosures because foreclosures are killing everything. And in it was, if you won't do it, we'll let the bankruptcy judge do something he never was able to do before, which is just snap a gavel down and say, this is what you're going to do, banks, on the mortgage. Bankruptcy can do second mortgages. They can do car loans. They can do, you know, loans for boats. But they can't do mortgages. Bankruptcy judge can't touch a mortgage. And so it was called the cram down, where the judge, you got a liberal judge, you're doing all right. He can just say that house is no longer worth $600,000. That loan is no longer worth $600,000. It's now $180,000. You're done. You know, go do it. And they got the Senate defeated that proposal.
I can understand that, though. It's a little frightening from the opposite perspective.
It is. But there's The bottom line is they're going to foreclose on that house. They're going to throw someone out of that house. What they're going to do is they're going to short sale, put the house up for short sale and reject all offers on the short sale. And then it's going to go into foreclosures and bankruptcy or whatever. The people are probably going to be in bankruptcy. The house is going to go into foreclosure and it's going to sell for 180 grand.
Yeah.
So why not let a judge just cut right to it? There's just one more family.
The reason is that I think there's still a delusional thought that they might be able to capture the price. You see it going on all over the city. For example, people are not removing buildings that I've seen for sale for over a year. This was before the bubble burst.
But the provision said that the beneficiary of that write down could never sell if they could get more money for that house. The first people who get paid back is the mortgage company or the bank that wrote down that it was if I lose we all lose and if I win we all win
right
situation, and they killed it and it was killed handily. It was killed 45-51.
I'm not saying I agree, but I understand why it was
why
done.
They would do
because
it
because I understand the perspective that the other side is coming from.
Yeah, I know, I get it. It's scary as hell for banks out there right now. I had a conversation today with my college roommate. Holy crap, man. He thinks Obama's all about class warfare and aiming everything at people who make 250 grand a year or more, aiming training his fire on them, and that they're going to get soaked, that the rich are going to get totally soaked.
Well, and
I honestly don't think it's going to be that way.
I don't think it's going to be that way, but I think that even if you are paying a little more in terms of taxes, so what? You know, I mean, there's something that's sort of naive about that thinking, and it's a little bit selfish, which is this. Generally speaking, if you're making that much money, you're benefiting from someone else's labor that isn't. That's just how things work. So, you know, cut me some slack here. It's hard for me to get out a violin for someone who's living on millions of dollars.
Yeah, no.
Because they don't have quite as much as they used to before.
I agree. And I think that's part of what is...
I don't believe in taxation without representation. I don't believe in unfair taxation. I don't believe that people should be soaked simply because they are rich. But, you know, what he's proposing is that taxation go back to a Reagan era level, which people were very happy with.
Yeah.
And big deal.
It happened during the Clinton era, and there were more millionaires minted during Clinton than any.
It'll be fine. You know, once, here's the thing I'm thinking is that once everything sort of happens and people who aren't as strapped as they are right now can start functioning again, we're gonna have another period of prosperity, and it won't be based on, you know, the bubble system, which is part of what he's trying to get away from.
I've been thinking about this, and I'm thinking we're headed into a period of low growth, which is good for the environment and could be termed sustainable. And I kind of think that's why he's talking about transforming the American economy.
Well, it does need to move away because, I mean, as we talked about, you know, there is this sort of bizarre thinking that growth is infinite, and in some ways, sustainability is a better model than trying to reach for the stars at all times. I think eventually if you're, if you're content with sustainable growth, you can still achieve the wealth and the power that you're looking for.
My example for that is in the early 90s, Clinton had 2-3% growth. And I think it was just spin. You know, they couldn't get it any higher. So they said, we just want it to be sustainable. And what you saw in 3 or 4 years was the 2% compounded started to pay a certain amount of dividends. And the second he went pro growth and got that thing up to 5-6% a year is when you saw, you know, the bubbles starting to be formed. And Obama's saying he doesn't want to form another bubble. But I don't think if you have this much deleveraging going on a small scale, on the me and you scale, not just on a institutional investor scale.
Well, every single person that we know is deleveraging. We all
except for once a week at the 4100.
Well, that's a different story.
Then we leverage something.
Good times are had by one and all.
But I mean, I think that he's saying, well, if we're going to be down for a while, why don't we transform things while we can go through the slow growth period?
The slow growth period will be temporary. I think American ingenuity will always find its way. And
That was, you know, the notion that every 5-7 years, the United States needs a new technology to flourish, to drive their capital.
It will come.
It's not always going to be housing and cars.
Yeah, and I think it probably won't be. And I think that, as we talked about before, I think the idea of the whole notion of cities and suburbs is something that needs to be rethought anyway. They're the most inefficient. We have two inefficient systems that are sort of imploding at the same time. You know, the suburban model is ridiculous. It's wasteful of land. It's bad for the environment. It's costly to live in, and it's sort of outlived its efficiency on every level. Right. And then it depends upon the automobile, because we don't seem to like to add public transportation to any of these things.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, we look at living in LA. I mean, you can't even get from one end of the city to the other after a certain hour. If you're in Santa Monica, you're stuck there until you know, it's insane. I mean, I've been there in the middle of the day, and it's like, I can't even get around the corner sometimes.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Do we really foresee a future where everything is like that? Where, you know, you drive 3 hours a day one way to your job and 3 hours back. Within this polluting car with a single driver on a freeway packed with a bunch of other single drivers sitting there, you know, like they're in a parking lot.
Right. What was that movie that was supposed to be about Seattle in the 90s? It was like a slacker.
Oh, Reality Bites.
Was it Reality? The one guy was trying to propose a monorail, and every character in the movie said no one wants to give up their car. It was like Reality Bites, but it was set up in Seattle, and it was like Bridget Fonda was in it.
I remember this vaguely. I was too young to go to the movies then.
Yes, me too.
I don't remember anything. I sort of vaguely remember that.
But that's what you're talking about. Like in that movie, his monorail gets squashed.
But no one wants to give up their car. But what I'm saying is that now the necessity is upon us.
Yeah.
You know, for us, here's what I'm trying to say. To continue to enjoy some aspect of the kind of life that we lead here, something's got to change.
Yeah.
Whether we like clean air. Or, you know, I don't know. I just think that we've got to give up something, and this is a good time to start thinking about it.
I think that this is possibly the only moment in American history where that thought could make its way through to the masses. I think otherwise, if things are going well, people are gonna
people remain the way they are. I mean, we all do. If you're comfortable, it's fine. Why change it?
Yeah.
There's no reason to tamper with it. But nobody's comfortable right now, so. Even the rich were complaining about more taxation and class warfare.
Yeah, they're calling Obama fascist.
Well, he is a fascist and a socialist. All those horrible things, isn't he? But
I tell you, rich people are up in arms over this.
Well, but aren't they the ones that caused the problem in the first damn place?
They get really mad when you say that.
But hey, deal with it.
Well, they say that America caused this problem.
America, well, they're Americans too, aren't they?
Well, they say that
the people who
took the loans caused the problems.
The people who took the loans did cause the problem, but let's face it, most of the people who took the loans intended to pay them back. You, on the other hand, did not concern yourself with whether they were actually viable
candidates for a loan or not. The particular antagonist in my mind in this discussion would say they knew very well they were getting way too much way too large of a mortgage. They knew very well that there's no way that they could pay it back.
Well, not really, because guess what? At the time, it was like, well, if you're clever, you'll flip this house and you'll realize the equity and you'll move on and you'll walk away with X amount of cash and then you'll live on the level that you're supposed to. And some people did that very successfully. Yeah. Others stayed in the game too long and voila. And some just wanted to live in their damned houses with their kids.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, I don't buy that. I mean, you know, there's responsibility on both sides. But most men and women who moved their families into houses did not intend to destabilize their lives or create a situation where they would become homeless or ruin their children's futures.
Right.
I don't buy that at all. That's really, really stretching, you know, morality and ethics on the part of the seller really far.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry. Yeah, because banks understand what it is to evaluate someone's worthiness for a loan. They know exactly, and they chose to turn the other way. I'm sorry. Contracts are two-sided and everybody's responsible.
I think that that's where we can all come to an agreement. The one thing, it was really great to hear from my friend. It started off with...
Well, explain what your friend does so has perspective.
Oh, I hate to quote him because he has a big giant I'm not quotable thing at the bottom of his email.
Well, we don't have to say who he is.
He works in a hedge fund in New York. And he, like myself, grew up Republican. And when you can get to a certain number of issues, you'll see that you see the issue eye to eye. But then there are X number of issues that he and I will never see eye to eye on. One thing that he said today that I thought was remarkable was this nation hasn't decided what its manufacturing base is going to be. And all I did for the last, oh, I don't know how many years in all of our email conversations was say, you don't understand, we need to make something. And he said, no, we go where the labor is cheapest. And I said, someday you'll see.
No, and I agree
someday
with you. Actually,
you'll understand.
Again, that we've been making that joke about outsourcing. But I mean, frankly, it has hurt us to not have a base here, to not continually have research and development going on in this country. These are the dangers of, you know, just having market forces drive everything. In the short run, I get it. You show profit, it all makes sense. But you lose cultural nuance. You lose a sense of what makes sense for the well-being of a people. Right. And this was the problem I was having even under Clinton, which was that the country started feeling like a place that was overrun by business forces to such a degree that the whole concept of Americanness started disappearing for me in a way.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this is the one thing that's happening right now is that we need to kind of pull that back and remember what we're about again,
right,
and start doing what we do best, which is inventing, building, constructing, and driving things.
Right.
And I think your friend should come around to your point of view finally.
Well, it was just startling to hear him say that. It was startling to hear him say
because they're having their freaking wake up call. This is what I'm saying. I listened to people throughout the last 10 years say the same crap to me. Well, it doesn't matter where it goes. It's we're showing a profit. Sure.
See, my dream is that we had this big conversation today about American business in general, and I said, I think there was a point where...
We'll forget these lessons and learn them all over again.
Half of these lessons are the lessons learned in the Depression in a different form. In the Depression, in the lead up to the Depression, there were popular culture songs that were basically like, we're in the money.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that came from the 20s.
We're in the money.
Yeah,
you know we had to do that.
Yeah, and what I found out as I learned more
wasn't
about
Lady
the Depression,
Luck mentioned there too.
Yes.
Yeah,
but what I found out was they were encouraging barbers and the man on the street to borrow money to put into stocks because the return was greater on stocks.
I've never heard of a scenario like that.
It created a bubble. And the damn thing blew up, and there were all these regulations put in. And that force found its way into the real estate market, where they encouraged people to borrow money because the 2-year return on your house will be greater than the ARM or the index ARM loan, which is the best. If anyone doesn't know what an index ARM, adjustable rate mortgage is an ARM. An index ARM says, I'm borrowing $500,000. I can't even afford to pay the adjustable rate interest only on it. I'm going to pay a fixed rate, and everything I don't pay that covers that adjustable rate is just added to the principal. It's indexed. And you better hope that that house outpaces inflation. Now, there were days, there were years where it was 20%. 20% on a $500,000 house, you come out with $100,000 in your pocket, $95,000 in your pocket, you can go buy another house. Your mortgage payment will go down.
All this sounds really familiar.
So anyway, but the point of all that is all these lessons to me are, like you said, we're going to learn them all again down the road. Hell yeah.
But you start listening to people, it's like, my God, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is common sense.
Yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, yeah, you can blame this, you can blame that. The fact of the matter is everybody joined hands and skipped down the primrose path together.
Okay, now, while we're on the subject of economics and the laws of gravity and things that are learned and relearned, it is freaking true that unless Obama gets entitlements under control, the lesson that we're learning is extreme spending will drive us into a wall, over a cliff, into a wall, use whatever cliche you want. And his first press conference said the reason why no one puts out a counter budget is the fact that the entitlements are really what destroy it. the entitlements are really what drive up the figures in my budget, in the CBO, and in the Office of Management and Budget Estimates. It's the entitlements. It's the built-in costs that don't go away. And he's saying he's going to get it under control, and I can see creative ways for you to do it. But if he does not, if Arlen Specter's defection wasn't to be the filibuster-proof vote to get him entitlement reform, then we will march headfirst into economic oblivion. I mean, that's the part. I can see what Obama's doing step by step on the international scene. I get where he's going with that. I can see it's like, it's not all at once, slow and steady, build it up, get our credibility back, et cetera, et cetera. I do not see when he's going to get Congress, which he's had to exclude from some of the hardest things he's doing right now. Yes. Congress isn't involved in the Chrysler Fiat deal.
No.
The Fed is doing half of its heavy lifting. If you put $4 trillion at the number of the stimulus, the Fed's done like 2.5 of it already for him. He put in 800 on his own. He's got to come up with the rest. I mean, he's trying to keep these guys away from the heavy lifting because they'll just fight about it and go nowhere. The Republicans will get a toehold and climb out of the gutter from there. climb out of oblivion. So, I mean, on those levels, I'm scared. Hey, let's just go through a couple of headlines before. Did you hear about John Edwards' wife's book?
Yes. She threw up when she learned about the affair.
Yes.
What else did she do?
She told him not to run.
Did they have a three-way?
She told him not to run.
Yeah, well, she was right.
And she was right.
Well, I mean, that was a no-brainer, but again, I guess he didn't think it was going to...
That was the I believe that to me was the beginning of the redemption of her. I mean, she was the victim anyway, but you know, you always scratch your head and say, why did someone stick with someone when they knew this was going on? And she just did what was right for political marriage,
mm-hmm.
for her husband's ambition. But
that's what's still. I mean, these women don't leave very often.
Yeah.
That creepy. What's that? Larry Craig, the one that got arrested in the restroom. He's still married.
Yeah.
Even though he's been caught in numerous situations like that.
I just have a wide stance when I take a dump.
You know, it's not really, really what I'm doing is not really, you know, illicit or illegal.
No, not at all.
Because it's me.
Yeah. Then did you hear about the rebranding conference that the Republicans are calling?
No.
It's brilliant.
Talk to me about it.
This is awesome. They've decided to brand themselves again. I'm going to get rid of this stupid...
I know, stop. I'm losing my sharpness here. Right. Too many interesting pictures. Stop it.
There is a conference where Republicans are going to get together and rebrand to figure out how to... And they're calling it rebranding, to rebrand themselves. All of the people who are running for president are going to be there.
Great.
Newt Gingrich is going to be there.
Great. He's a loser.
Yeah.
He won't... He's too
much of a mess. Bobby Jindal is going to be there.
Another loser.
The person who has a disconnection, who people said, McCain said, yeah, I heard she's coming. And her people in Anchorage said, we're not sure if she's going, is Sarah Palin, who...
She's another loser.
I don't get what kind of... Her connection to the base is just falling apart by the minute.
As well it should.
I'm very excited to see what they come out here.
It'll be so much fun. I want to go.
I kind of want to go.
Yeah.
They said it won't be just Republicans, but of course it will be just Republicans.
We'll have to.
The quote of the week for me.
I have to be careful because they'll really want me.
They probably would. You would be the new ideal face of the Republican Party. Speaking of the face of the Republican Party, do you hear about
Mr. Steele's latest petulance?
Well, he's lost control of the purse strings of the party. Newt Gingrich attacked the crap out of him this week.
Well, he deserves it. They deserve what they got with that idiot. Because what they were trying to use him for is so painfully obvious and ridiculous. They didn't examine the content of this idiot's character.
Well, the part
character.
That cracks me up is that a guy who just barely missed winning the Senate, is destroyed. His political career is destroyed. If he became a Democrat, it would be destroyed.
What's destroyed these days? Ever, really?
He came within a breath of winning that seat. And he's now... I mean, his party doesn't... He's disgraced within his party.
Well, he didn't play by the rules. And he's also much too... he doesn't have the coolness, he doesn't have a cool head. He's very, you know, volatile. He says all sorts of crazy things. I mean, but then again, what do you want from someone who was talking about doing hip hop outreach? I mean, there's just something so pathetic about a middle-aged geezer like that talking about hip-hop outreach and expecting to be taken seriously by anybody who's over the age of 12.
And by the way, the only chance he had to make inroads in it was when he was on D.L. Hughley and then had to recant
when the Great Rush.
Yeah, he made more news about kowtowing to Rush Limbaugh than he did in all the progress he made. He seemed like a reasonable human being on that show.
He did, and I think that might have been the real him, but the game is too tough. Well, that and then the pro-choice equivocation. Yeah. You know, it's tough because this is the thing. If as a Republican, you simply cannot be pro-choice. And end of story.
Yeah.
It's anti-abortion all the way. And listen, I despise abortion, but I think it should be available to those who want it.
I still think it's a woman's right to choose.
But I think that what we need to talk about is getting better education about prevention so that we do not have to resort to such things.
Well, that's where they kill you. The anti-abortion forces say we can't educate people about sex because then they'll have sex.
You know, but that's okay. This is where they can kill themselves. This is naive. It's unrealistic. And frankly, the states that are most heavily Republican have the biggest problems with these issues. Yeah. This is the thing that they always forget to look at. Everything they're up in arms about happens under their watch.
Yeah.
Drug abuse, sexual issues. Welfare moms.
The states that get
which they always forget
80.
Is a white woman with multiple fathers. That is the average woman on welfare, not a black welfare queen.
The states that get $1.80 for every dollar they send to the federal government are Republican red states in the South.
Yeah, no, it's painfully hypocritical and painfully unexamined.
Which I mean, let's get back to the Republican Party. They are. I guess this is the law of nature. This is almost like throwing an egg up in the air and watching it just land on the floor and crack. But I don't see why the opposition had to go through what they're going through now. I don't see why the Republicans have to be such a clusterfuck mess right now. I don't get it. I don't get it. If I were in charge of the opposition, there are two roads that you would take. But one is just be purist in the Reagan sense. The other is be accommodationist. They're
doing neither. And this is the problem. I mean, exactly. Your opportunity is now. If you think you have better ideas, then it is a damn good time to come up with them.
Right.
A really, really good time to show up the Democrats by coming up with better ideas and position yourself as the savior of a country that is very much in turmoil. Right. I don't see that happening.
I agree with you. I think the one problem that they have with that is that there's no way to come up with an alternative policy position because...
Well, they tried with their budget with no numbers.
Well, yeah. No, in my conversation today with my dear good friend from college, I said, I'm sick of this hybrid approach to this economy. So, because his thing is shut these banks down, nationalize these banks, sell those assets... Get them off their books.
Isn't that what the
take
plan
what
is?
Remains and bring them back. And he
that's
says,
the
yeah.
Plan.
And he agreed that that's a plan that they're just taking forever to get to it because it's politically untenable. But, and I said, well, I'm like, either let's do that or let it all crash. And he said they did that in 1930.
Yeah, we can't. Exactly. That's the problem.
So
we can't function without. Because it will suck every dime that all of us have down the tube with it.
But the thing is, and what I said is then. There is no Republican alternative. If a form of subsidy is in the solution, there is no Republican alternative.
Their strategy seems to me to be the third thing, which is to just hope that it all goes to hell and stand on the sidelines and say, "I told you so."
Obama right now has to weather some shit that are the laws of gravity.
Yeah,
they revised
we're past the point where you can talk about what you inherited. It's yours now.
Well, beyond that, the reality about the problems we're facing won't go away and haven't gone away with the euphoria over the stimulus package or the banking bailout.
Well, did we really expect it to go away in 3 months? I think that in the beginning I was terrified and wanted a miracle, but now I'm much more realistic about what is going on and how long it's going to take.
Yeah,
I don't think it's going to happen overnight.
Let me ask you a question. When they revised the downward trajectory, the negative growth numbers for our economy for the first 3 months of this year were revised to show a decline of 6% per year. The economy was dropping at a rate that it would, if it kept up at that, it'd be 6%. A boom year is 6% growth.
Right.
We're in the mirror opposite of a boom year.
Yeah, it's called bust.
It is. But the point being is Obama's going to go through a summer of this.
Yeah.
He's going to go through a summer of this.
He predicted it. I don't think it's going
to. I guess it's his plan is to say, I told you so.
He has been saying it from the beginning, even though we were seeing signs of recovery, blah, 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 that there were still going to be, you know. As we've said, we liken it to somebody swallowing a lot of toxicity. I mean, it is literally that. It's not fully digested yet. It's going to take time.
My big problem is that if that's the case, then the party of no might actually pull out a victory in 2010.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. They're talking about showing signs of life in the economy at the end of 2009, which means from the lows of the unemployment, like from the depths of unemployment, that they're not going to, you're not, if that's a lagging indicator, you're not going to see job growth. You may see positive figures in October of 2010. You may. The only thing you have to hope for is the fact that Republicans are so disorganized. But all right, so here we go. Let me just give you, this is my quote of the week. It's the quote of the day on Political Wire from today. And it's a reason why I kind of like this guy. This guy is the new John McCain. And he's been kind of the new John McCain for some time. Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina. He's a Republican. He's not a Northeast. There are no Northeastern Republicans right anymore. His quote is, and I'm reading this straight off of politicalwire.com. Do you really believe that we lost 18 to 34-year-olds by 19%, or we lost Hispanic voters because we are not conservative enough? No, this is ridiculous. This is a ridiculous line of thought. The truth is we lost young people because our Republican brand is tainted.
Well, he's right.
There's only thing I would correct that with. It's bankrupt of ideas.
It's bankrupt of ideas. The faces of the Republican Party are terrifying right now. They're not making any sense. There's no room for younger, fresher ideas. They reject them. Yeah. I mean, I'm saying, you know, the Meghan McCain, who would be sort of an anointed princess of that realm, is being treated like hell by them.
Yes.
And she could be used so effectively. It's amazing to me.
Yeah.
And for her to, you know, but whatever. I shouldn't root for these people, but it sort of boggles my mind.
Well, I think the world would be a better place if moderate Republicans came back into existence.
Yes. To temper the thinking, we need, I think that the idea of a two-party system makes sense. We need the balance. We need the debate. It's good.
That there are times when a true moderate Republican's hard to beat in a debate.
But where are they?
I don't know.
They don't
supposedly
seem to exist.
Arnold Spector was one. And every time I read about this guy, I'm like, he is so not a moderate.
No, he's...
He's so not a moderate. But anyway. Okay, well, we're basically at the time we usually wrap the show.
All right.
I'm going to go back to an old...
Forgive me for being so distracted by those amazing pictures.
By the way, I know some of those photos.
Yeah, I was like, hello, guys. If you can see what I'm seeing, what I've been seeing for the last hour, you'll know why I'm not talking as much as I usually do.
Let me just throw one thing out there. I'm going to go back to Reagan or Carter, and this week he was Reagan. The press conference, the town hall,
yeah,
he was Reagan. He was Obama, but he was Reagan.
He's definitely a great communicator, and that one, you know, that's not going to go away.
Now the only other thing I can.
I mean, even the Republicans had to give it up to him. They feel that, I mean, Newt Gingrich's sort of perverse assessment of the first 100 days is that, yeah, the man's been extraordinarily successful as a politician, getting what he wants, moving the levers of government. The substance of it terrifies Newt, of course, because he thinks that as we've been talking, we're going to turn into a socialist republic. Bordering on fascism or whatever the hell they're little
we're
weird
not,
epithets.
We're not.
We're not going to do that. This is still America, idiots.
All right. Well, on that note, that has been what's left for this week.
Bye, everybody.
And you can listen on Podomatic anytime or iTunes at any time. What's Left Podcast. And of course, on Is Good Radio from the delightful new studio. We'll see you all. Oh, wait, next week you're in.
Yes.
I hate to do this to you on the air, but Sam Tolles, who started the show with me in 2003, was available to be on the show next week.
Great.
I think it would be awesome. I haven't talked one lick of politics with him since 2008.
Do it.
So I think it would be a very interesting show. So next week we should have a guest, Sam Tolles, whose uncle is Tom Tolles, the cartoonist for the Washington
Post. Nice.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Can we have a Republican too?
In the same show?
Yeah.
You're itching for that.
I am.
You're totally itching to get a Republican on the show.
Yeah, I want to get Chris Kourakos.
I don't want to start. You want to do both? No. First of all, the podcast can still hear us. We have like 20 more seconds, and I don't want to do the Lion's Den with.
I do.
We'll see. We'll get one more. Let's get one more genteel guest, and then we'll start doing the
Battles
to death. All right, and there
taste
goes.
For blood.
It tastes for blood.